Chapter 6. 30th of October, 9 p.m. 9 hours until low tide.
"Well, I think that's enough talk of murder for young ears for one evening," says Lily. "It's way past your bedtime, young lady."
Trixie stares at her.
"Mum, I'm 15. "Then start dressing like a 15-year-old instead of a toddler with a candy floss crush. Go on, the adults in the family need to relax."
"You mean you want to smoke?"
"Say goodnight to everyone, then up to bed," Lily snaps. "You can read one of your boring books. That should send you to sleep."
Lily has never understood the pleasure of reading. To be fair, I've never understood the pleasure of Lily. She is the kind of person who only ever borrowed library books in order to rip out their last pages, then give them back.
"We haven't even had dessert," says Trixie. "If my waist was as big as yours, I wouldn't even say the word dessert. Don't you ever wonder why boys don't like you?"
Trixie stares at her mother from behind her pink glasses. I can see the tears starting to form in her eyes, but she blinks them back with an air of defiance I'm rather proud of. She walks around the table, kissing each of us goodnight. It still seems miraculous to me that someone as cold and uncaring as my sister could produce such a kind and sweet child. As soon as Trixie has left the room, Lily lights a cigarette. She seems oblivious to the way we are all staring at her.
"Why couldn't I have been blessed with a normal, sulky teenager? No boyfriends, not one. And her female friends dress like nuns and speak like nerds. I wanted a cheerleader, but all she talks about is charity. It's like living with Safi from Ab Fab, but worse, boring me to tears with her books and opinions about global bloody warming all day long."
"You should be grateful she isn't a handful like you were at that age," says Nana.
"Can I quickly use your landline?" Lily asks, ignoring the comment. "There's no signal on my phone here."
Lily, who loved gadgets as a child and spent a great deal of the 1980s having a close personal relationship with Pac-Man and her Atari, is the only person in our family to have a mobile in 2004. Dad had one the size of a brick when we were little, but it cost a small fortune to use, so it was mainly just for show. Lily picks up her dark blue little Nokia from the table, and we all stare at it as though it were a piece of rock from the moon.
"Sorry, Lily, my phone doesn't work anymore," says Nana, clearing some of the plates.
"Why not?"
"I stopped paying the bill."
"Why would you do that?"
"People kept calling me.
I didn't like the constant interruptions."
Lily looks furious, but I'm sure her tongue must be covered in bite marks because she doesn't say another word about it.
Instead, she starts playing a game called Snake on her otherwise redundant mobile. I find myself staring at it over her shoulder, mesmerised. Nana is as keen as always to show an interest in our lives and hear all our news. Stories change a little each time they are told, even when they are as rehearsed as ours. Like children, they grow and evolve into something new, something with ideas of their own. Stories are also lies, and we're all storytellers in this family. Nana starts the routine questions with her son.
"I don't wish to sound unkind, but my father's favourite subject is always himself. Dad is also rather fond of regurgitating things he's heard on BBC Radio 4. He is an intellectually promiscuous man who gorges on the thoughts of others, then shares them dressed up as his own. Second-hand ideas sold as new." He seasons his sentences with the odd long word because he doesn't want people to hear his lack of knowledge or education. "The piano was his first and only true love, and music is the only subject he has ever really studied. Tonight, as always, he talks with passion and pride about his orchestra, the cities they have visited recently, and the musicians he has worked with. My mother rolls her eyes and makes light work of sweeping up all the names he keeps dropping, insisting that she's never heard of any of them. How is your veterinary practice, Rose? Nana asks, moving the conversation along like a verbal pass-the-parcel party game. Still standing, Rose replies. It's impressive that you've built such a successful business from scratch at your age. But how are you holding up? I'm holding up fine on the rare occasions I'm not falling down. Rose has always been able to keep her cool when it comes to quick-fire questions. And what about you, Lily? Nana asks. Any luck finding work? My other sister has been unemployed since forever. She survives on job seeker's allowance, despite never seeking a job, child benefit and handouts from Nana. Lily takes another cigarette from her pocket, pops it between her pink lips and lights it using one of the candles on the table. She stopped smoking for a while when she was pregnant, allegedly, but has since given up giving up. She takes a long drag, then exhales smoke and boredom over the rest of us. It's really tough to find work at the moment, she says, using a wine glass as an ashtray.
It's always harder to find things if you don't look,
Dad mutters, and everyone stares at him, including Lily. Excuse me, she says, getting up from the table and leaving the room, presumably to check on Trixie, but also to have a little sulk upstairs, no doubt. My sister has always had chips on both shoulders and throws more tantrums than a toddler. I'm expecting Nana to ask whether I am still volunteering at the care home. It might not be exciting or earn money, but being kind has its own rewards, and I am proud of what I do. But my mother launches a new attack on my father before the conversation turns to me. Why must you always be so hard on Lily? Bringing up children on your own isn't easy. I should know, Nancy says, as soon as her favourite daughter is out of earshot. If looks could kill, my father would have been in the morgue some time ago. I've often wondered why my mother loves Lily the most. Perhaps because she sees herself when she looks at her. Like a walking, talking mirror of youth, showing her who she used to be. Dad tries not to take the bait, but bad habits are hard to break when you've got over 30 years of practice. She's not a child anymore, Nancy. She has a daughter of her own, though it's no wonder she forgets so often when you have taken on the role of being mother to them both. Well, someone has to help our children. If we'd all gone off gallivanting around the world to follow our dreams, then help her. You smother her, always have. It's no wonder she never learned to stand on her own two feet. She is what she is because of you. And what is that exactly? An entitled, spoilt, selfish, lazy, brain-dead bore of a woman who still behaves like a child because you never stop treating her like one. She cares more about her looks than her own daughter, and she's still completely irresponsible with money that isn't her own because she has never lifted one of her manicured fingers to earn any.
Lily appears in the doorway. She clearly heard every word. Nobody knows what to say. The silence that follows isn't just awkward. It's painful. We all watch as Lily walks past the kitchen table towards the fridge, then opens the door as though searching inside for answers. When she can't find any, she opens another bottle of white wine instead. All families experience conflict, whether it is between husbands and wives, parents and children, or siblings. It's as normal as day turning into night. But unresolved conflict spreads like a cancer in human relationships, and sometimes there's no cure. Despite everything, I still have some happy memories of us all together, tucked away inside the folds and creases that forced us apart. We weren't always the us we are now. It's Nana who I feel most sorry for. She's made such an effort to create a lovely evening for everyone, and, as usual, my family has found a way to ruin it. Who would like some early birthday cake and champagne? She asks, with a weak smile. Me, I say,
raising my hand and trying to diffuse the tension, for now at least. I notice that Rose has barely said a word all night. She speaks when spoken to, but only offers short, succinct replies. I might have been the baby of the family once upon a time, but I find myself frequently worrying about my eldest sister. It's a special kind of love that holds families together, even dysfunctional ones. Our love is like an intrinsically woven net made from a million memories and shared moments. The knots in the net are tight, but there are holes, just big enough for all of us to slip through if caught the wrong way. The weather outside has worsened, providing a soundtrack of rain tapping at the windows, and the candles sometimes flicker when the wind howls. My mother and Rose help to clear the table before Nana reveals one of her famous homemade chocolate cakes and takes her favourite champagne sauces out of the cupboard. They look like they're from the 1920s, because they are. Dad does the honours, expertly opening the bottle as though he does it every day, and Nana stands up, holding her glass and looking like she might make one of her speeches. I just want to thank you all for coming to Seaglass to help celebrate my birthday tomorrow. It means the world to me to have the whole family here together, and you've made an old woman very happy. 80 is going to be a big birthday for me, and if the palm reader in Land's End was right, it might be my last. You are the only people I wanted to spend it with. Here's to the darker family, she says, raising her glass. The darker family, everyone repeats, almost in unison, before Nana continues. I also want to thank Amy and Ada for providing us with a delicious dinner tonight. Who the hell are Amy and Ada? I thought she cooked the meal. Dad whispers to Rose, taking another sip of champagne. The chickens, Rose whispers back. She named them after Amy Johnson and Ada Lovelace, two of her favourite inspirational women, remember? Frank almost chokes as Nana continues. Amy sadly passed away on Monday, and Ada died 3 days later. An act of widowhood if ever I saw it. That little chicken died of a broken heart. I feel as though the whole room stares in my direction again when she says that, and glance down at my hands. Is it safe to eat a 10-year-old chicken? My mother asks, looking nauseous. I suspect so, Nana replies. Safer than jumping off a cliff, at any rate. On a related subject, I don't want to be the richest woman in the graveyard, and I'm sure you all want to know what happens when I die. I'd like us to enjoy the time we have left together this weekend. So, rather than keep you in suspense any longer, I have decided to share my will with you tonight. Chapter 7 30th of October, 9:45 p.m. Less than 9 hours until low tide. If Nana didn't have everyone's attention before, she does now. Dad leans in, my mother sits up, Lily puts down her phone, and Rose stops making an origami bird with her napkin. This is my final will and testament, Nana says, putting an envelope on the table and staring at each of our faces as though committing them to memory. My solicitor witnessed me signing it earlier today and has a copy. I promise that I've thought about all of this and all of you very carefully, and I'm sure it's for the best. Before I begin, I'll remind you what I wrote at the start of my favourite book. The future is a promise we can still choose whether to keep. The past is a promise we've already broken. I meant those words, and I believe that the present is my only chance to protect this family's future. She turns to face my dad. Frank. Yes, Mother? I have left you my clocks, all 80 of them, in the hope that you might use the time you have left more wisely. His mouth falls open, but Nana continues without waiting for any words to spill out of it. Nancy, my beloved daughter-in-law, you gave me 3 beautiful granddaughters, for which I will always be grateful. I am leaving you my drinks trolley. Like you, it's now an antique, but still good for holding liquor. My mother's face is a picture I wish someone would paint, a beautiful mix of shock and outrage. My sisters are both grinning like the naughty schoolgirls they used to be until Nana turns to them. Rose, I am leaving you my unpublished artwork and brushes, in the hope that you might paint a happier future for yourself. Lily, when I die, all the mirrors in this house will belong to you, in the hope that you might see what you've become. Nobody is smiling now, including me. I'm terrified of what Nana might say next. Daisy is the only person in this family who never asked me for a penny, she says, smiling in my direction. I plan to leave a sizable sum to her favourite charities. Thank you, I say, and Lily pulls a face. I am grateful, really I am, but I confess that I always secretly hoped that sea glass might be mine one day. I don't think anyone in this family loves this place the way that I do. Nana takes a sip of her champagne before carrying on. My literary estate will continue to make donations to my own favourite charities as long as there are sufficient funds for it to do so. I will be leaving sea glass in my great-granddaughter's precious hands. I hope we can all agree that Trixie is the future of this family. My home will be held in trust for her alone until she is older, along with any other royalties and future payments from publishers. Hang on a minute, interrupts Lily, lighting yet another cigarette. She takes a drag, then exhales a cloud of smoke. You're basically going to leave everything to my daughter, a child, and nothing to me. You finally lost your remaining marbles. Rose smiles at the outburst. Unlike the rest of the family, she seems completely indifferent and unoffended. Nana sighs. Not everything, Lillian. Please stop smoking in my home. Before those tiny cogs in your small mind start trying to turn, the will prevents you from taking a penny of what will one day be Trixie's. Besides, I'm not dead yet. You need to learn to make your own way in life. The world doesn't owe you anything, and neither do I. But it may or may not please you all to learn that I have started working on one final book. You haven't written anything new for years, says Dad. Well, I didn't have anything left to say. But now I do have one last story I'd like to tell. It's about a dysfunctional family, not unlike ours. What? Says Nancy. You've written a book about us? Lily asks. I've started sketching out a few ideas, is all Nana says. Dad slams his glass down on the table without meaning to. Well, I can't imagine that selling many copies. What I want to know is why. Why invite us here if all along you plan to leave us out of the will? I'm your son, your only child. Please keep your voice down, interrupts Lily. Trixie is already asleep upstairs. Because the future of this family and what I will leave behind when I am gone has been on my mind for a long time, Nana replies. I think she's about to say something else, but she doesn't. Instead, she is silent and wide-eyed, like the rest of us, when we hear the melancholy sound of the wind chimes outside and the front door slam at the other end of the house. It's almost 10 o'clock. The tide is in. I can tell we're all thinking the same thing. It's not possible to walk across the causeway at this time of night, and nobody else was expected to join us at Sea Glass this evening. Maybe Trixie woke up, whispers my mother. And went for a walk outside in the rain? I don't think so, Lily replies. I think we all know that it isn't my niece we can hear out in the hall. Every member of my family stares at the closed kitchen door in horror, as the sound of heavy footsteps coming down the hallway gets closer. There is a collective holding of breath when the door handle slowly starts to turn. Chapter 8. 30th of October, 10 p.m. 8 hours until low tide. Dad leans back in his chair, Nancy gasps, and Lily swears as the door bursts open. The candles on the table flicker, casting an eerie pattern over all the faces sitting around it, and only Rose keeps her wits on a tight leash as a man appears in the doorway. He is backlit from the light in the hall, and it takes a few seconds for me to recognise the shape of who is casting a new shadow over the evening. Connor steps into the kitchen. The man I have secretly loved since he was a boy has been a stranger for too long. I've spent a lot of my life in love's waiting room, not being noticed by those I want to see me. Other people seem to find it all so easy. Lily has never had any problems attracting attention from the opposite sex, but I've always been a little awkward in that way. I never know what to say or do when I like someone, so I tend to say and do nothing at all. Still, nobody here would have approved of me having a relationship with Connor. Not then, not now, not ever. I'm about to say something, I think we all are, but Nana beats us to it. Connor, welcome. I didn't know whether you'd come. You invited him, asks my mother. Connor might not be a Darker, but he is part of this family, says Nana. That depends on your point of view, says Dad, staring down at the table. Connor ignores the comment. I tried to call to let you know that I was running late. I got stuck at work, but there seems to be a problem with your phone. There is. It kept ringing, so she had it cut off, Lily says, taking another large gulp of champagne, as though it were lemonade. Well, I wanted to be here, he says. Nana's face is lit up like a Christmas tree. She always adored Connor, just like all the women in this family have at one point or another. The man I see now in the doorway, looking a little lost, reminds me of the boy he was when we first met. There are some memories we can never outrun. It was a hot summer's day when we all first saw 9-year-old Connor Kennedy with his bucket and spade. He was sitting alone on what we had come to think of as our beach, just opposite Sea Glass. It was as though he were trespassing. Black Sand Bay is a public part of the coastline, but nobody ever visits this particular stretch of black sand. It is too difficult to get to without scrambling down the cliff, and there are plenty of signs about the dangers of swimming in the sea. I don't believe in love at first sight, but something at first sight happened to the women in my family that day. All of us. I was 4, Lily was 8, and Rose was 9. We lived in a world of our own during those childhood summers at Sea Glass, while my father was busy touring the real one. Nancy would drop us off in July and reappear in August, leaving us alone with Nana for the weeks in between. On the rare occasions we dared to ask where our mother went when she left us, the answer was always the same. Somewhere else. My sisters missed her more than I did. But then I've always loved sea glass. It's the only place that has ever really felt like home. Strangers were a strange sight in Black Sand Bay. We all stopped and stared that day, including Nana, at this perfect-looking boy sitting on our beach. So out of place. He seemed to fit right in. Lily was the first one to speak, as usual. It wasn't exactly Shakespeare, but it was the question we all wanted to ask. Who are you? The boy glanced in our direction, looking unimpressed. What's it to you? Lily's hands formed fists and found their way to her hips. We live here. Connor looked the same age as Rose, but acted a lot older. He stood up, dusted the sand from his hands, and copied Lily's stance. Yeah? Well, I live here too. He took a yo-yo from his pocket and started playing with it, without taking his eyes off us. Things get a little hazy after that. Sometimes our memories reframe themselves. Nana bridged the gap between herself and the boy, leaving us behind. She had seen the bruises on his neck, the shadows beneath his eyes, the details only age teaches you to translate. She asked him where he lived, and he explained that he and his father had just moved into a cottage along the coast. What about your mother? She asked. 9-year-old Connor stared at her, and the yo-yo went down and up several more times while he decided how to answer. I don't have a mother anymore. Our parents are away all the time too, said Lily, misunderstanding. Nana invited Connor to come across the causeway and have lemonade with us. She wanted to call his father to tell him that the boy was safe. Things didn't used to be how they are now. Children didn't know they might need to worry about an adult offering them a cold drink on a hot day. Connor said yes. Sometimes I wish he'd said no. I remember him walking across the causeway with us for the first time, still yo-yoing as though his little life depended on it. He was officially the most fascinating creature 4-year-old me had ever seen. Our new neighbour lived a mile away, but that isn't far at all when you are a child and in search of company. Connor didn't have any other children to play with, and sisters are rarely satisfied to be with one another when someone more interesting comes along. He became a permanent fixture in our lives, and I think I might have fallen in love with him that day. I liked the taste of his name in my mouth and on my tongue, so much so I would whisper it to myself on the days he didn't come to visit. It felt like snacking between meals. That chance meeting with Connor and his yo-yo changed the shape of my family forever. We spend our youth building sandcastles of ambition, then watch as life blows sands of doubt over our carefully crafted turrets of wishes and dreams, until we can no longer see them at all. We learn to settle instead for flattened lives, residing inside prisons of compromise. A little relieved that the windows of the world we settled for are too small to see out of, so we don't have to stare at the castle-shaped fantasies of who we might have been. There are two kinds of attractive people in the world. Those who know that's what they are, and those who don't. Connor Kennedy knows it. His good looks gifted him an unshakable confidence in life, the kind very few mere mortals experience, and fear of failure is a stranger he has yet to meet. He wears his stubble like a mask, always dresses in scruffy jeans teamed with smart shirts, and his blonde hair is long enough to hide his blue eyes when it falls over his face. He doesn't look like a journalist, but that's what he is. 30-something, going on 50, and addicted to his job. Tonight, Connor's white cotton shirt is clinging to his chest, and a small puddle of water has already formed around his feet where he stands in the kitchen doorway. He looks like he might have swum from the mainland, but that's not possible. We all learned a long time ago that the riptides between here and there can be deadly. My dad, seemingly sober all of a sudden, asks the question we all want to know the answer to.
How the devil did you get here?
By boat, Connor says.
By boat?
Yes, they're a fantastic invention that you can use to sail across the sea, Nana says. I get my post and groceries delivered by boat once a week now, too, so I don't have to cycle into town or worry about the tide.
I expect they don't deliver after 10 p.m. in a storm, though, do they?
Interrupts Dad, narrowing his eyes at Connor, like a comedy villain with a sense of humour bypass.
What kind of boat? A boat with oars, Mr. Darker. You came here in a rowing boat, in a storm, in the dark.
Yes, I'm sorry to arrive so late. I got held up at work. There was a murder.
This would sound strange, coming from most people, but Connor is a crime correspondent for the BBC. His press pass is still dangling from the lanyard around his neck.
I managed to borrow a small boat from an old friend, Harry, from the fish shop. The storm isn't as bad as it sounds, and it isn't as though I haven't rowed a boat across Black Sand Bay before. I feel as though I might be interrupting, and I don't want to be a party pooper, but I wonder if I might head upstairs and change into some dry clothes?
Of course, says Nana. It isn't my birthday until tomorrow. I'm just glad you're here in time for that. Before you disappear, I found something belonging to you. She shuffles over to the sideboard, opens a cupboard door, and takes out an old Polaroid camera. It looks like a vintage item from a museum, but I remember when it was brand new.
Would you mind just taking a quick snap of the family? Who knows when we'll all be together again?
Connor takes the camera from her. We all, reluctantly, lean in, and he takes a photo, before passing the white square to Nana. She attaches it to her retro fridge with a strawberry-shaped magnet before the picture has even developed.
Thank you, Connor. I suppose Daisy's room would be best for you to sleep in. It's the only one with a spare bed. Unless that would be too...
I don't mind, I say, a little too quickly. The thought of sleeping in the same room with Connor starts a little fantasy inside my head, one which I've had several times before. Lily pulls a face, but I ignore her.
That's fine with me. We're all grown-ups. It's just somewhere to sleep,
Connor says, and my fantasy deflates. You can't make someone fall in love with you. I don't know much, but I do know that. The rest of my family exchange glances, which I choose to ignore. Do you remember where it is? Nana asks.
I'm sure Connor remembers everything about Daisy, says Rose.
It's one of the few times she has spoken tonight, and her words feel like a slap. I excuse myself and leave the kitchen. Connor does the same and follows. I don't mind sharing a room if he doesn't. He used to be like a brother to me. I don't say a word as we walk through the hallway and past the cupboard under the stairs. I was locked in there once as a child, and I give it a wide berth. The staircase itself is a rather grand affair, and unique in that the entire wall next to it is covered with a hand-painted family tree. Time-warped branches stretch across cracked plaster from the floor to the ceiling. Nana did it, of course, illustrating our lives as though they were the same as her books. Another story to be told. We're all on there, dangling on fragile-looking twigs. She has painted us in the same style that she illustrates her children's books, using a pot of black ink and various-sized dip pens and brushes. Sometimes, if she is in the mood, she will draw the outline of her characters with a reed from the garden. Then, when the ink is dry, she colours them in with palettes of watercolour paints. She likes to portray people, places and things the way she sees them, which rarely matches the view of those being drawn. Her characters are all as flawed as the world they live in, but children love them, maybe because of the honesty that shines through what they get to see and read. Other children's authors seem to sugarcoat their books in an attempt to make the world less scary. But Nana always told it like it was, and her readers loved her for it. Miniature faces of the Darker family, past and present, painted inside the tree's giant black leaves, permanently look down on the mistakes we've all made. It makes me feel an overwhelming sadness. The idea of this one day being a place I can no longer visit whenever I want to. We all have roots in this family and in this house. It isn't something I think any of us can just walk away from. Connor and I head up the creaking steps to the first floor, and only when we reach my old childhood bedroom and the door is firmly closed behind us do I whisper, "Why did you have to come here?" There is an ivory-coloured metal daybed against the back wall of my old bedroom. Nana bought it second-hand for all the times when she slept in here, too scared to leave me alone in case my heart stopped in the night. Sometimes I would wake up and see her staring at me in the darkness, whispering words I couldn't quite hear. Connor puts his bag on the daybed as though marking his territory, then starts to change out of his wet clothes with his back to me. I sit down on the very edge of my bed and turn away. Maybe sharing a room wasn't such a great idea after all. It takes a lot of courage for me to ask the question. Could we maybe just talk about what happened? But Connor doesn't answer. It's been like this between us for a long time. No matter how sorry I am, he can't seem to move on, just like my sisters. I know he'd probably rather never see me again, but I'm glad that he chose to come anyway this weekend, for Nana. What happened certainly wasn't her fault. The rest of the evening is a blur at best. I'm exhausted, but I never seem to be able to sleep these days, and the atmosphere in the house feels even more polluted than before. We heard the others decide to turn in and call it a night too, almost as soon as we left the kitchen. Nana's room is the largest bedroom at the back of the house, and she whispers good night as she passes my door. Lily and Trixie take the room that Lily and Rose used to share as children. My mother is the last person to come up. I only know it's her because I hear her talking to someone in a hushed voice at the top of the stairs. "We'll get out of here as soon as it's light. I knew the old witch wouldn't leave us a penny." I listen at the door as she scuttles along the hall to the guest bedroom she used to share with my father. Rose stays downstairs, choosing to sleep on a sofa in the library. Dad also said he would rather stay downstairs, sealing himself in the music room that was his sanctuary as a child. He always needs to disappear inside his music when the real world gets too loud. But Seaglass is no longer noisy. It has returned to its own variety of silence. I can hear the sea outside my window, and Connor's slow and steady breathing. I can tell he's still awake. I keep completely quiet when I hear him get up and tiptoe across the room, and I listen as he opens his laptop on the desk in the corner. There's no internet here, but it seems that Connor still can't resist doing a little work this weekend. He's become a workaholic since getting the crime correspondent job at the BBC. Perhaps because when you work that hard for something, sometimes you live in constant fear of losing it. He creeps out of the room, presumably to use the bathroom down the hall, and while he is gone, I get up, cross the threadbare carpet to his side of the bedroom, and stare at the laptop screen. What I see is nothing to do with work. It looks more like a poem. Which is odd, because Connor has never been one to dabble with fiction or anything creative. He is a man who only likes to deal in facts. Or, at least, He was. I hear footsteps in the hallway, creaking floorboards telling tales on anyone out of bed, and I know I have to hurry. In a childish attempt to get Connor's attention and make things less awkward between us, I type a Halloween-inspired message with my index finger. I can't type properly, and am dreadful with modern technology, but I smile to myself as the letters appear on the screen.
Boo.
Then I return to my side of the room, watch and wait. Connor stares at the word when he returns, then spins around, frowning in my direction. I wish he'd say something, anything, but as usual, he doesn't. Connor stopped speaking to me around the same time as Rose, and nothing I say or do seems to change things. Sometimes the way he stares so hard at me seems to physically hurt. I'm like a word he can't read or a puzzle he can't solve, just like the Rubik's Cube he couldn't work out as a kid, no matter which way he tries to twist me. Connor lies back down on the daybed and faces the wall. I turn my back on the disappointment I feel, wondering why he still can't see me for who I am now or talk about what happened then. Nobody can run away from their own shadows, but he's always been determined to try. It's cold in this part of the house, and I shiver on the other side of the room as I lie on the bed that was always mine. I blink into the darkness, listening to the sound of Connor's breathing as he pretends to sleep again. There are a galaxy of stars on the ceiling. They are the glow-in-the-dark sticker variety, and almost as old as me. I expect they will continue to shine long after I am gone, just like the stars in the sky. And sometimes it feels as though nobody in this family would really notice if I just disappeared. Sometimes I think they wish I'd never been born. I close my eyes, and a single tear escapes them, rolling down my cheek and dampening the pillow. Sometime later, I hear a noise downstairs. I have never been a good sleeper. I'm not even sure whether I was asleep just now. That nightmare people sometimes have where they feel like they are falling? I have it all the time. When I check the clock in my room, I see that it is almost exactly midnight. A few seconds later, the 80 clocks downstairs begin to chime their agreement. As soon as the final clock strikes 12, I hear a terrible scream. Chapter 9. 31st of October, midnight. 6 hours until low tide. The screaming stops.
Did you hear that?
I whisper. But Connor isn't there. I rush out of my bedroom, along the landing, down the stairs, across the hall, and into the kitchen at the back of the house. My niece is standing in the middle of the room wearing pink pajamas that make her look much younger than she is. Trixie is crying. When I look down, I can see why. Nana is lying on the floor in a white cotton nightdress. Her eyes are closed, her skin is grey, and there is a large gash on her head and a pool of blood beneath it. Poppins the dog is lying next to her, and neither of them are moving. A chair has toppled over as though Nana might have been standing on it and fallen, and I see that there is blood on the Aga oven where it looks like she could have hit her head. Everything becomes silent and still inside the room, and seconds seem to stretch into minutes. Even the sea and the rain outside are suddenly quiet as I take in the scene, as though my world has experienced a freeze frame. Then the sound of Trixie crying plays in my ears again. Tears are streaming down her face.
"Shh, it's okay. Just tell me what happened,"
I say to Trixie, rushing over and getting down on the floor next to Nana, careful not to touch her or make things worse. Nana, can you hear me? She doesn't move, but Poppins looks up at me with sad eyes and starts to whimper.
She'll be all right, old girl. We just need to stay calm.
What the hell is going on? Why are you out of bed and what's with all the screaming? Asks Lily, marching into the freezing cold kitchen wearing nothing except a pink silk nightdress. Her daughter runs to her side. Most teenagers are children dressed up like adults, but my niece is still a child in so many ways.
Oh my God,
Lily says, seeing Nana's body.
Is she?
I don't know, I whisper. What happened? Asks Rose, appearing from out of nowhere and fully dressed as though she must have slept in her clothes.
Stand back and let me see.
Why? Lily asks. You're not a doctor. Lily takes a step closer to Nana and Poppins starts to growl. I have never seen or heard the dog behave this way before. Rose steps between them.
It's okay, Poppins. We're just trying to help Nana. Come on, old girl. Move out of the way.
Poppins does as she is told, as though she understood every word Rose just said, and watches from a short distance with her head bowed, quietly whimpering. Rose gently feels for a pulse, but I don't need to be a doctor or a vet to know that this isn't good. The gash on the side of Nana's head looks deep. She's lost a lot of blood, and I have to look away when I see what might be brain matter in the red puddle on the floor. I've seen the same shade of grey skin on the faces of too many residents at the elderly care home where I volunteer, and fear I know what it means. Connor appears in the doorway, fully dressed, like Rose, and I wonder what took him so long and where he has been. Lily turns her back on him and tries to comfort Trixie. That's when I notice Nana's hands. One is holding a copy of Daisy Darker's Little Secret. The other is holding what appears to be a cigarette. But when I take a closer look, I see that it is a piece of chalk. I stare at the black wall at the end of the kitchen. The recipes and sketches that were there earlier have all been wiped off. Instead, there is a poem, just like the ones in Nana's best-selling book about me. But the words have been changed. The book begins with the line, "Daisy Darker's family were as lovely as can be." But the chalk poem on the wall is very different. Look, I say, and one by one, everyone in the room turns to read it. Daisy Darker's family were as dark can be. When one of them died, all of them lied and pretended not to see. Daisy Darker's Nana was the oldest but least wise. The woman's will made them all feel ill, which was why she had to die. Daisy Darker's father lived life dancing to his own tune. His self-centered ways and the pianos he played danced him to his doom. Daisy Darker's mother was an actress with the coldest heart. She didn't love all her children and deserved to lose her part. Daisy Darker's sister Rose was the eldest of the three. She was clever and quiet and beautiful, but destined to die lonely. Daisy Darker's sister Lily was the vainest of the lot. She was a selfish, spoilt, entitled witch, one who deserved to get shot. Daisy Darker's niece was a precocious little child. Like all abandoned ducklings, she would not fare well in the wild. Daisy Darker's secret story was one someone sadly had to tell. But her broken heart was just the start of what will be her last farewell. Daisy Darker's family wasted far too many years lying. They spent their final hours together, learning lessons before dying. Nana must have been writing it when she fell.
Why would she write such horrible things about all of us? Lily asks.
I watch Rose and Connor staring at the chalk poem, but they don't have an answer to the question. None of us seem to know what to say or do. Lily, who always finds silence too uncomfortable to wear, dresses it with the sound of her own voice again. "I've just realised that it's Halloween," she says with a weak smile. "Maybe this is some kind of trick-or-treat prank." It's true. Nana did always like playing tricks on us at Halloween. It was her favourite night of the year for lots of reasons. She believed in the ancient Celtic origins of the festival and would remind us of them each and every year when we celebrated her birthday. The Celts, living in England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales over 2,000 years ago, believed that on the 31st of October, a portal between the living and the dead opened, allowing lost souls to return to Earth. Nana was always willing to believe that ghosts were real, but it was the only time of year she believed they walked among us. "Do you remember when Nana taught us to play trick-or-treat when we were children, lighting lots of candles and scaring us with her ghost stories?" Lily says, as though expecting Nana to sit up and laugh at us all for being so gullible. "This is no trick-or-treat," says Rose, wiping a rare tear from her cheek. She's dead. Nana. Daisy Darker's Nana was the oldest but least wise. The woman's will made them all feel ill, which was why she had to die. Nana said she loved her family, but it wasn't always true. The old bat was more bitter and angry with them than any of them knew. She wished her son had been born a girl or not been born at all. The granddaughters were a blessing at first, but her hope soon hit a wall. The first was too clever, the second too daft, so the third was her only hope. But the child was born with a broken heart, and Nana knew she'd never cope. Nana led a rather lonely life, with a dog for a best friend. She started to fear that death was near, thanks to a palm reader in Land's End. When the time came, no one knew who to blame when she was found with a blow to the head. It was hard to grieve for a woman so peeved. At least one of them was glad she was dead. Chapter 10. 31st of October, 12:15 a.m. Less than 6 hours until low tide. "Who found her?" Rose asks, looking at everyone until her eyes come to rest on Trixie. "Was it you?" Rose is better with animals than she is with children, and Trixie starts to cry again. She looks so small and vulnerable in her pink pyjamas. I have an overwhelming urge to hug her when she takes off her glasses with one hand and uses the other to wipe away her tears. Rose adjusts her tone. "Can you tell us what happened?" Trixie does her best to answer between sobs.
"I just came down to get a glass of water. Nana was on the floor. When I touched her, she was cold. When I said her name, she didn't answer."
She starts to cry again.
"We need to call the police," says Connor.
"What on earth for?" asks Lily. "It's obvious what happened here."
"Is it?" he asks.
"Yes, a chair is turned on its side. Nana was obviously using it to stand on while writing one of her bonkers poems on the chalk wall, and she must have slipped."
"I don't think we can know that for sure," Connor replies.
"Well, what I know is that you're a crime reporter, not a detective, and nobody asked your opinion anyway," says Lily. "This is a family matter. You are not family, and I don't even understand what you're doing here."
Even for Lily, this is rude.
"What I'm doing right now is wondering why an elderly woman I cared very much about is lying on the floor looking as though someone has bashed her head in with a blunt instrument."
He turns to Rose.
What do you think happened?
She stares down at the kitchen tiles as if she can't look him in the eye.
I think Nana just died and I'm very upset. I'm sure we all are. Like Lily said, I'm a vet, not a doctor.
She glares at him, and I'm glad I'm not Connor.
This is not the time for any of your conspiracy theories or wild accusations. Nana was never anything but kind to you, welcoming you into her home and our family. Try to show a little respect and compassion if you haven't completely forgotten how.
Rose turns away from him and hugs Lily and Trixie, both of whom are now crying. I go to stand next to them, as though silently choosing sides. I'm going to miss her so much, I say, unable to imagine life without Nana in it.
I just can't believe she's gone, says Lily.
Rose holds her closer. I know. Neither can I.
But she lived a long and happy life, and we will get through this.
Someone needs to tell Dad what has happened. Rose has always looked at the rest of the family as a problem with no obvious solution, a problem she doesn't quite know how to solve. When nobody else replies or makes a move, she sighs. I guess that'll be me, then. We all watch as she leaves the kitchen and pauses in the hallway, outside the door to the music room, where our father chose to sleep. Rose's head is as tightly tucked in as her shirt. She stares down at the floor and I can almost hear her mind whirring. The music room was one of the few places we were never allowed to play when we were young. Rose hesitates before knocking, like the little girl she used to be, the one who was afraid of getting shouted at for interrupting her father's work. She knocks and we all wait, but there is no answer. Rose knocks again, before gently turning the handle and pushing the door open. The room is empty, she says, looking back at us all. The camp bed hasn't been slept in. Dad isn't here and neither are his things. Lily rushes forward and grabs Rose's hand just like she did when we were children. I know he was upset about Nana and the will, but you don't think that... Let's try not to jump to conclusions, says Rose, even though I'm sure we've all hurdled over several. I'm going to find a sheet to cover Nana's body. I'd rather remember her the way she was. Can someone else go upstairs and wake Nancy? I volunteer and Connor comes with me. I expect he just doesn't want to be left alone with my sisters, but I'm glad of the company. The house doesn't feel the same to me now, as though it, too, is grieving. Sea glass is colder and stiller and quieter than before. All I can hear is the sound of ticking clocks in the hallway and the gentle lapping of waves against the rocks outside. When I was a little girl, I used to imagine the sea coming in through the cracks in the walls and the doors and the windows and rushing down the chimney while we slept in our beds until sea glass was full to the ceiling with seawater and we were all floating and trapped inside. I used to imagine a lot of bad things happening to my family in this house, but only at night. I might not be a child anymore, but I am still afraid of the dark. Connor stops on the landing and I notice that there is some chalk on his jeans. He sees it too and tries to brush it away. I don't say anything. The door to my mother's bedroom at the other end of the hall is slightly ajar. I freeze and realise that I simply don't have the right words for this situation. Connor, as though sensing my apprehension, steps forward and clears his throat. He knocks ever so gently, but the door swings open a little further, and despite the gloom, we can both see the shape of someone in bed. I don't understand how anyone could have slept through Trixie's screaming, but my mother has always been a deep sleeper. Never less than 8 hours a night, or she thinks it will be bad for her skin. A good night's sleep is something pills and alcohol have often helped her to achieve.
Nancy, I'm sorry to disturb you, Connor says. What? Who is that?
says a voice in the darkness. But it isn't my mother sitting up in the bed. It's my father. And he looks just as surprised as we are to find him there. Nancy sits up seconds later, lifting her eye mask and removing her earplugs before squinting in our direction. When she sees Dad in the bed next to her, she practically leaps out of it.
This isn't what it looks like, she whispers in our direction.
Yes, it is, Dad says with a sigh, before holding his head in his hands. The idea of my divorced parents sharing a bed leaves me speechless. Connor clears his throat again.
There's been an incident, and I think it might be best if you both come downstairs to the kitchen when you are...
I fear he is about to say decent. Ready is the word he settles on, and we leave them to it. Back downstairs in the kitchen, the mood has changed from disbelief to fear. Nana has been covered with what looks like a red and white tablecloth, and my sisters are staring up at the chalk poem about our family. The chalk was in her hand, Rose says. Nana's handwriting is beautiful and very distinctive. The poems in her children's storybooks were all handwritten with ink. I used to try and write the same way, with sloping, joined-up letters, but it never looked as good. Nana had an explanation for that, just like she did for everything else. Of course we all have different handwriting. Just like fingerprints or DNA, it's to remind us that we are individual beings. Our thoughts and feelings are there to be expressed, and they are our own, unique. I don't feel the same way as you about the world, and that's fine. We're not designed to always think and feel the same. We are not sheep. Agreeing with someone about something is a choice. Try to remember that. Don't waste your life wishing to be like someone else. Decide who you are and be you. I'm not convinced that the poem was written by Nana, I say. I don't think this looks like her handwriting. Maybe someone just wanted it to look like...
It's impossible to know who wrote this for sure, Rose interrupts.
But why would Nana write that? Asks Lily. And if she hated us all so much, why invite us here? I'm not precocious, says Trixie, my precocious but wonderful niece, staring up at the words written about her. It's almost a relief when my parents enter the room, looking like a couple of teenagers who've been caught behind the bike shed.
Oh no,
Dad says, rushing to Nana and pulling back the cloth that was covering her. His reaction seems staged, and I notice that the dog starts to growl again.
It's going to be okay, Frank, says my mother, coming to stand by his side, still wearing her black silk pyjamas.
Her matching black eye mask that she can't sleep without is still on her head, too.
We'll get through this together.
It feels like an odd thing for her to say, given they've spent most of the last 20 years apart. I wonder whether she might still be drunk. We watch as my parents embrace in front of us for the first time since 1988. People hold on tighter when they think they are losing their grip. The moment is punctuated by a full stop in the shape of a crying teenager.
I want to go home,
Trixie sobs.
Why don't you go and watch TV in the lounge? Lily suggests.
Television has always been a surrogate parent in my sister's house, but she looks cross when Trixie turns to me for reassurance.
Everything's going to be okay, I promise, I say, wondering if it's a lie.
It's very sad that Nana has passed away and we're all going to miss her. You go and turn the TV on, and I'll come and join you in a minute.
People tend to see what they need to see and hear what they want to hear, in my experience.
Trixie nods, wiping away yet more tears with the sleeve of her pink pyjamas before leaving the room. As soon as she is gone, the discussion about the chalk poem on the wall continues. I listen, while they all bicker about what it means and what we should do, unsurprised that nobody asks my opinion. As the youngest in the family, I'm quite used to nobody really caring what I think. I zone out a little and notice the 8 jack-o'-lanterns still sitting on the kitchen table. They all have such scary faces, which Nana must have spent a long time carving. There are pumpkins, squashes and turnips because, like always, Nana liked the tradition and folklore of Halloween more than the commercial version of her favourite day. Every year, when we were children, she would help us to carve jack-o'-lanterns of our own, while telling us the story of their origin, the myth of Stingy Jack. The Irish legend claims that a man called Stingy invited the devil for a drink, but then refused to pay for it. It was a trick, one of many that Jack played on the devil until the day he died. But then God wouldn't let Jack into heaven, and the devil, rather tired of a lifetime of tricks, refused to let him into hell either. So Jack was doomed to purgatory, with nothing but a burning coal inside an old turnip to light his way in the darkness. I guess turnips morphed into pumpkins at some point in history, but then all stories told often enough bend and twist out of shape over time. Stingy Jack is the reason why we carve pumpkins and put candles inside them to make lanterns at Halloween. One of my greatest gifts is knowing a little about a lot of things, and Nana taught me about most of them. She said the lesson of the legend was to pay your way in life, or be doomed to be forever lost and lonely in the dark. She was obviously very upset with us all, says my mother, snapping me out of my trance. I think that was clear last night, too. I've been wondering for a while whether Nana might have been suffering from some form of dementia. This, she points at the chalk poem without looking at it, unpleasantness is completely out of character. Perhaps she just worked herself up and then, what, worked herself up, wrote a poem and died? Asks Lily. This might turn out to be a blessing in disguise, says Nancy. How can you say that? I ask, trembling with anger. My mother ignores me. And this display of dementia, along with her odd behaviour last night, might mean that her will simply can't be taken seriously. If she was out of her mind when she wrote it... She wasn't out of her mind, she was just speaking it, says Rose. Nancy glares in her direction. Before they can start to argue, we all freeze when we hear the sound of Nana's voice in the distance. It's time for you to meet the rest of the Darker family, my darling girl.